Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled The Human Canvas. Yes, that is what it's called. That's what we decided. And it's about art, risk, and vulnerability. Our guest for this episode is someone who knows about risk, art, and vulnerability. Three-time podcast guest Lori Hauser. Hi.
Hi.
Hey, say something for yourself.
Hi, I'm Lori Hauser. I'm also known as the Mad Muse. Matt is asked me here today to talk about all the things he just listed.
Yes. And all of the wonderful things that you are doing right now.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, from the top.
Yes.
Coming up in March, on March 9th, 10th, at 11th, in Bellevue at a house, we're going to be doing the Literary Brothel. And it is a brothel where we will have sacred whores that will have books. The stories that we are picking from is actually Grand Guignol stories that inspired what became the Grand Guignol Theater. These are the actual stories. And so our literary whores will be reading selections from Grand Guignol stories, and people come into the house, and yeah, that's it. And we're going to do that.
So could you explain Grand Guignol for the kids at home who don't want to quite go to the Google app on their phones? You know, while other people might be listening, but in the privacy of the podcast, this is a no judgment zone, kids.
Grand Guignol is a theater, French horror theater, that rose out of the naturalist movement of theater. It was very raw and very real. Raw and real to the point of extreme, and that's what it made it Grand Guignol. It was horror, it was rape, it was murder, it was acid throwing, and it was also hypersexualized. So there was sex, there was nudity. It was in Paris. It rained, I believe, up until the 60s. They finally closed the last one in the 60s. And one of the main reasons that the Grand Guignol theaters were closed, there was one in Paris and there was one in London, they closed because the world itself became more horrific than what was happening on the stage.
Mm.
So, but we want to revive that horror theater here in Pittsburgh, mainly, you know, outside of, you know, just represent a historical theater piece. But also to, you know, this is the Paris of the Appalachia.
That's right. There is a book called that.
And it should have its Grand Guignol Theater to tell its horror stories, especially as a zombie kingdom. especially, you know, all these special effects people that are doing all this stuff.
The long trail of Tom Savini.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, this is another root of horror. This is probably what would have been considered your original horror house, with live actors bleeding and naked and screaming on stage.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Sounds like fun. And so there is and again, this will all be linked, you know, when we post this on the interwebs and stuff. So there's a Facebook event page for this?
There is a Facebook event page. There is an Eventbrite page where you can order tickets. You will find it also on my Patreon, which we'll talk about in the links, I guess.
Yes.
And yeah, it's out there. It's out there under the Mad Muse. Just look it up.
Just look it up. Get the Google, kids. Now you can Google, and we won't judge you. So that's the first thing. So what else you got going on?
Okay, so that's March. April, I'm going to Shen Fringe, which is a fringe festival in Staunton, Virginia. Of course, it's in their second year. They are, I'm going to head out to a fringe in Virginia, and, mm-hmm. and I'm doing Mad Love there.
Okay.
So this is the thing that I want to do as far as what I'm traveling with, what I'm touring with, where I'm going in these festivals, is I want to tour more themes about love, along those lines of we should just love more. Okay. And this is what it looks like in this hyper-intense Mad Muse kind of way. So, yeah, we're gonna have Mad Love going on at the Shen Fringe in April. April 9th and 10th for anybody that's in Virginia.
Cool. And?
May. Okay. So May is the big deal. It's another big deal. It's all a big deal. I'm really excited about all this stuff. So May, we're doing Morosin Macabre's Atrocity Exhibition. In its ninth year, it has won Best Production in Pittsburgh from the City Paper for the past 2 years. So for the ninth year for the exhibition, we are doing Inferno, which means we're doing our retelling of Dante's Inferno and not Paradiso, the one in between.
Purgatorio.
Thank you. We're going to do those two. And we're doing it in not your typical way. Of course, we're going to do it in a dark arts kind of way. We've got our usual suspects coming from around the country, and we've added some new performers. I'm not the stage manager this year. I'm performing this year.
Fantastic.
I'm Dante.
Ah, there you go. That's a good job for you, Dante.
Yeah. And then,
you either want Dante, Virgil, or Beatrix.
Right.
You know, right? I mean, that's what you got, and Beatrix doesn't really do anything. She's just kind of there as an idea.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know.
So I'm playing Dante, and we are putting this on during the Dust Bowl era. Yeah. And Lilith DeVille is Virgil, the poet.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
We have a Hellevator, where we go down through the levels of hell on stage and we meet all the different monsters.
Fantastic.
At each level. Yep. And Dante is actually not this pious religious dude. He's a hypocrite.
Good.
And we have totally made him a hypocrite. You know, like he's, you know, he preaches to people about how, you know, he has seen hell. And then that's when Virgil shows up and says, oh yeah, wait. And takes him to hell.
Great.
So that is how we're doing. That is our theme. That is our theme this year.
Fantastic.
We are doing two nights this year instead of one because we sell out. We've sold out for the past like 3 years, I think. So we finally took the dive, and the Morosin Macabre, who are real people, decided to go for two nights this year.
Fantastic. Which I think makes sense for Dante too, because you know, you think the slow burn of working on that thing for 20 years, and by the end, you know, figuring out ways for people to be down there who were still alive at the time.
Right.
Like, that's
like, oh wait, this person died. Let me throw them in this story right now.
Yeah. Oh, they didn't die yet? Well, let me tell you.
It's coming.
So I'll put them down there now and do a whole demonic possession thing. His souls already fell to hell, and yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that makes sense. And so you also have the book, Mad Love.
Yeah.
You talk about the book.
Yeah. So the book was an idea that happened because I am dating this guy that wanted to make porn.
Okay, that which is a start of most artistic endeavors.
It started the internet, right?
Exactly. The internet and home movies. The
yeah.
VCR had to be porn.
Had to be.
And the internet, porn. And I think virtual reality is waiting for porn.
I don't know how it hasn't happened already.
And that's what we'll all like, oh, look, we're going to go David Attenborough's Planet Earth. But really, you're there for the other stuff. Anyway, so
the edge
porn.
Of all, the edge of all great things is porn.
Oh, dear.
So I was like, well, you know, So Mad Love became not only my exploration in having this very romantic and wonderful relationship, but also the nudity, the bodies, because I am, and I'll say it, I was raised Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm raised in Puritanistic America, where we think that bodies are unnatural and horrible and terrible, especially if they're not photoshopped and perfect.
Yes,
so,
and especially if they're naked.
Yeah, so let's take two very imperfect-looking people. I wouldn't say we're horrible to look at.
But it is you and Ed.
And we're midlifers, which is like, you know, it's not like we're in our 20s flipping our shit out.
Yeah.
You know, I've got I built a baby body, and I'm a 45, well, at the time we did the photo shoot, I was 45. I'm a 45-year-old woman, so, you know, I'm not Nope, not photoshopped. So we did this very natural photo shoot with the poetry I had written about my feelings, about the relationship I have with this man, and our romance and how I feel about it. And we put it into a book, and the photos, like, the poetry's written on its body. There, of course, I got the boob shot in there. There's, like, one shot of me naked. Yeah. With poetry. And then in between the photos, the poetry is handwritten into the book. So you get, like, you have the readable copy, and then you have the photos.
Mm-hmm.
So it was this... my attempt at art porn, you know?
Yeah.
At, like, art porn, romance, love, the weird feelings of, you know, accepting our own naked bodies as viable, wonderful things.
Yeah, which is, I think, gets to this question of vulnerability and risk.
Right? Yeah.
You know, because I guess even, like, you can have this idea, and then you can get a photographer... And even then, there's still the moment of, okay, and now the clothes have to come off.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, to love someone is to be vulnerable to that person.
Right.
Which takes... And so there is these dimensions of vulnerability that are happening.
Yeah.
Where it is, you know, well, do you accept this? Do you want this? Are you okay with this?
Yeah. And kind of, well, in the poetry, I do... Like, in the poetry of the book, too, a lot of the vulnerability is that idea of mature love. That you accept the end in the beginning. Like, in the one poem, Elegies, I say to not accept these horrible ends is to never accept these ever-flowering beginnings. So this, even though it's mad love, even though it's romantic, and it's, yeah, let's whip off the clothes, let's be romantic, there's still that element of mature and deep love and something that you elevate to. Like, you accept the moment that you decide to love or give in to love, you accept its end. And in that is where you find... the miracle of the moments and the enjoyment of it. And that vulnerability of saying, okay, this will end. So let's go.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, too, there is that... Honestly, I often think about, you know, our own troubled era and our own troubled times and how we weirdly live in this age of infatuation.
Oh, we're disposable.
Course, yes.
We're as disposable as the razors that we make.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And also then, too, this idea of if there is not perfection in a person, or in what we see that person, yeah, you can go get another one.
Yeah, no, and that's, but see, now here's my thing.
Okay.
And I talk about this, I've been trying to address this issue of deeper love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you not only embrace the love... In the emotions and the romance and the everything, but you embrace the imperfection.
Yes.
Because if you can't look a person in the face and accept that you might have to wipe their ass when they are old and ugly and wrinkled, you are not in love. Or you're in love, but you're not in deep love.
Yeah.
If you're not willing to want to...
Wipe their ass.
Wipe their ass and go through the hard times in life... then you're not in deeper love. You're in that disposable razor love. That like, very surface, like, you know, that perfect love that really does not exist. That whole thing, it's crap. It doesn't exist.
And it always ends, generally, if we can talk about, not particular people we know, but lives that we've seen other people live, and we've been friends for how long now?
Oh, 20 years? 20?
Yeah, I think it's 20, yeah. 97. 20 years, man. Jeez, two decades.
Ah, yes.
Us knowing each other.
The madness ensues.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way that ends. Way that, and I will say this too, and I can say this as a man, most misogynists I know also have this platonic ideal of womanhood. And that the misogyny and the pedestal are the same gesture.
Yeah.
And the same, as Zizek would call it, the same side of the same coin.
Yeah.
You know, and I think about that, and I think about this question of, you know, the way in which our art and our culture and the sort of mainstream stuff does not teach us how to be human anymore.
We don't allow it. We don't want to see that. I mean, here at, okay, as artists, we are supposed to define the culture. But through consumerism and capitalism, we are allowing it to define us. And therefore, yeah. We're not promoting humanism. We're promoting entertainment.
Yeah.
We're promoting consumable goods. We're promoting nice quotes and pretty things. And that's fine.
No, it's not.
To a point. Right. No, yeah. It's not. To a point. Once we as artists stop promoting humanity and stop promoting empathy and great thought, and, you know,
human imperfection,
then, you know, we've lost the game. We are no longer viable. You might as well defund us. We're worthless.
So dark. But no, I think that is the point. And I think, you know, for those people who do want to defund the art, I think, or whatever, or who don't see any purpose in, I think that is, you know, there is a fundamental flaw in the humanity of many people today, or most people, or I dare say a majority of people, or whatever.
Right.
That, you know, you think even a Make America Great Again is an infatuation with an idea of America. It is not a deep love for everything about this place. It is a fetish. It is a selection. It is a small, narrow, you know, a narrowing, an inability to accept the whole person.
Right.
Yeah. Or the raw person, even.
Right, yeah. And that's where I promote theater's empathy. That seeing live performance raises the empathy so you can look at the raw person and experience with them.
But there's no CGI explosions,
though. No. See, that's it. That sucks. You gotta drop the screens. And you know, like that... if I have any answer for anything, it is the reason that we need the arts back in our culture and in charge is we have to be human again, and we have to show people how to be human again. You know, Mad Love is a project, and this is how I'm human. I'm vulnerable, I'm naked, I'm in love. Ta-da!
Yeah.
You know, so that's how the art can reach people and say, look, you're allowed to be vulnerable. You're allowed to be frightened. You're allowed to be. And this is how we show these things. You know, this as actors, as performers, we show these emotions that are not seen because we can't look at them. We don't know how to anymore. We may, but it's very difficult for us.
Yeah. It's almost like we're in this perpetual 1950s cycle.
Ugh.
You know what I mean? Where I'll never forget one of my high school teachers said about how he, you know, having the image of Donna Reed on his TV vacuuming in a ball gown. And he's saying about actually, and it was kind of this anecdotal thing, but I never forgot it. And I don't even know if he fully comprehended. I know for a fact he didn't fully comprehend what this meant. But he said he thought his family was weird because his mom did not vacuum while wearing a ball gown.
I could totally believe that. But, you know, it's all, you know, like, to take that, you know, like, even further as far as, like, you know, thinking it's odd because, you know, your parent or your mother, your, you know, particularly the wife, does not act a certain way. You know, the thing is, it's a shame that that's a gender role.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we get into, it's not so much the institution of marriage and it's not so much the misogyny of the pedestal. It's, we have kind of gotten away from our nurturing as people.
Yeah.
And now we look at these nurturing acts as subservient roles and they're not.
Yeah.
You know, if you love someone, you want to take care of them.
Yeah.
You want to care for them, and it's a partnership. Yeah. It's an equal thing.
Yeah.
So, to, you know, to have this image that all, you know, women should be in ball gowns pushing vacuum cleaners.
Yeah.
Undermines the vision of nurturing people in that way. Do I make sense?
Yeah, I think it absolutely does. And I think it is this sort of troubling thing for how, you know, sort of that belief system or that how that fundamentally flawed idea of human perfection.
Yeah.
Destroys people from the inside, it feels like. You know, to me, or at least what I've seen in our 20 years of knowing each other, and
right, the other
20 years before I met you. It is this problem that I think people face where, you know, there's something even Betty Friedan says this in the preface to the second edition or the 10th anniversary edition of The Feminine Mystique,
yeah,
where she says about how a woman no longer has a private image by which to judge herself.
Right.
And that it is maybe this completely commercial idea, yeah, of what it means to be a woman or a human or whatever. And so I know a lot of the scholarly exploration I've done is to take a look at, well, how does this apply to everybody? And how, yeah, I mean, is empathy now a sort of radical act? Is it a privatized act that almost sort of, what I mean by privatization, it is owned by someone else.
Right, yeah.
You know, and people get their sense of themselves wholly through this weird, distorted funhouse mirror of commercial culture.
Right.
And what does it mean to break away from that? And what does it mean to even to sort of take the risk to explore that kind of stuff, whether it is as a patron or as an artist?
Well, that's it. And I think, you know, like in the project of Mad Love, in the act of artists as being very natural and very human.
Mm-hmm.
As an artist, as for me, it's exhilarating. It's exciting. I mean, I would think that artists would want to become this vulnerable reflection of the direction that the world should be heading.
Yeah.
Because it's self-discovery, which is another great thing art does for us as artists. Not only are we trying to work out answers in front of people with these vulnerable moments, we are discovering. You know, we're discovering these moments as answers.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah. I'm not quite sure what else. I mean, like,
yeah, no,
being
no,
vulnerable in that natural human
human way. And I guess it's like, you know, and too, you know, you and I had sort of the same encounters with the same people who've helped form us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Rosinskis at St. Francis Theater. It's weird too, because sometimes I think about how, you know, trying to embody these things in myself, you know, and I have my own issues. I often, like, sometimes say to people, I used to say this a lot, I don't like to be reminded that I have a body. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and it is, you know, how I grew up, which is nice because the podcast is this totally disembodied voice, right?
It's, yeah.
You know, people who know me or people who don't know me, who might be listening to this, right? You know, I don't even have a picture on there of what I look like on the page.
Yeah, they don't even know what you look like.
Yeah. And I'm okay with that, you know?
Right.
And I think that's nice, or that allows me to maybe hide a little bit, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think about how, you know, and this spray orange tan. You know, and you think about how dangerously insane that human being is.
Ugh.
And how it's very obvious, like, when you see that spray tan, and you see the edge of that spray tan, like, that you have this very marked line,
mm-hmm,
between his skin, his actual skin, and the skin that he, you know, there's now photos where you see where the line is, and that right next to his hairline, what Donald Trump actually looks like in this. And you think about how incredibly then dangerous it is for maybe a human being that is not comfortable within their own skin. And how obviously that has gone mainstream and that has gone normal. I mean, I felt the same way. I'll never forget my mom We won't unpack that human being. But I will say, reading the feminine mystique is like, oh, that's my mom. That's what's wrong with my mom. But anyway, my mom sent me a box of Paula Deen knives. And this is before the racism, before the slavery parties, before everything. And I just remember, like, this picture of Paula Deen's grinning perfect teeth and absolute perfect makeup, pancake makeup. And I was like, oh, my God. And it just freaked me out. And, and then you have these knives that you... I never had sharp, real knives before. You pull them out, and they would make the shing sound. Of the, oh, God! And there goes my fingers. And this image of this face, you know, and this thing that wants to cut me, and this face. And I remember thinking, like, finally, it took me a while to realize, wow, that is a human being that is not comfortable in her own skin.
Yeah. That's a lot of people. We're not. We're not, and we're not promoted to be comfortable in our skin. Just like we're not supposed to be comfortable in our relationships.
Yeah.
Our relationships need to be perfect. Our bodies need to be perfect. It's not going to happen, you know? And that's why I feel art and doing this kind of, like, human canvas, writing on people's bodies, because that requires, like, two things first off to make the piece. You have to touch another person. Oh my goodness.
Yes.
That's been a problem for years. I think I've been doing pieces as the Mad Muse about touching other people since for like the whole 15 years.
Yeah.
It's just been so we're afraid to touch people. So to do the human canvas, to write on another person, we have to touch each other. There's physical contact. Holy man. The second thing is that if it's chosen to be written on near a body part that might be considered exposing oneself, one's private body part, there's your next vulnerable layer of the human canvas. And this is how this art works for me right now. And it's just one of those things that I, you know, with, and starting to work with other artists on this, you know, the human canvas is getting them to tell me what words or what visions, and I just interpret it, and we just have this experience, and then I make it live, and I take it out in front of people, and in that, I, you know, like, my work's actually, you talked about the Rosinski's Kenny.
Yeah.
When I first started doing the Mad Muse, he called me an emotional stripper. This has been a term floating around for like 17 years. The emotional stripper.
Emotion. And what does it mean to be an emotional stripper?
Well, it's stripping off your layers, your emotions, you know, and just digging and getting deeper with them. And so back in the day when I did like the big piece, like the big like 40-minute piece, that was exactly it. It was pulling back each layer and revealing more and more until you're that exposed human being.
Yeah.
You're emotionally exposed to everyone. Like, okay, here you go. You know, I've stood up here and told you about how my life has been frustrating because I can't find my place in the world. I've stood here and told you about, you know,
yeah,
in this very, like, mad poetry, rant, classical literature, classical theater kind of way. It's emotional stripping. That's what it's become.
So here's a question then. Here's a sticky, thorny question. Because with any writing, with any art, there is also this notion of editorial control, right? I mean, is there for you a place where it's like, ooh, I don't know about that yet. Is there still boundaries to this, or is there still things you have not worked out yet in this emotional stripping?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Sometimes these pieces are not polished when they come to stage. Yeah. Sometimes the ink is still drying.
Yeah.
And if I don't have an answer, I don't give an answer. And none of my answers are for anybody but me. In the making of the art, it is the hope, since it's the Mad Muse,
yeah,
that I inspire the answers in other people.
Yeah.
It's that planting the seed. You know, you're like, okay, here's where I left off. Go.
Well, I guess then too, though, this question of, though, in this emotional stripping, is there any place you don't want to go yet? Is there any place for you that maybe the inkling of the idea is there and you just go, not yet, not quite, maybe never?
The only thing I really honestly, when I think about that, of course, I would have to think of my own deepest personal fear. And that would be, I don't ever want to have to deal with the death of my own child. I don't ever want to have to write that.
Mm.
I could write about death. I think we should talk about death more.
We must.
Yeah. I appreciate people that are joining death cafes. They're following the order of the good death. They're beginning to incorporate death as a natural state of life into the culture.
Yeah.
And see even some of us as a personal motivator to get shit done because death is coming.
Yes.
But do I want to emotionally try and imagine? Like, in my personal situation, that death? No. That's where
Yeah.
As far as, like, human things, like sexuality, love, hate, jealousy, fear, the whole thing, nah. I think it's the point of the madman. Here it is. Madman, madwoman, okay, is to delve into the waters and bring back the stories. That's so. If you look at emotions as something you can delve into, as I get older and the more I engage in this, I enjoy engaging and delving into those emotions and bringing back the stories. Because how many people don't anymore?
Yeah.
We take meds.
Yeah.
When we do delve into those emotions, it's very controlled therapy of some kind, or there's a system, there's a program, there's a something, which is great. Whatever you need to delve into it.
Yeah.
I do it through art.
Yeah.
You know, and especially if emotions are taking me over and I'm like, ah, you know, yeah, start writing art, start writing things down, start making things that speak back to you or give you your answers or structure where you're at emotionally.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, show it to your friends, say, am I insane? dress it up, put it under a light, call it art, whatever.
This is the Marcel Duchamp thing, right? Instead of a urinal, it's just
right.
Your emotional bullshit. It's your emotional urinal.
It's my emotional urinal.
That's what we'll call it next time you're on. Went to Kai for the emotional urinal.
Right.
R.R. Mutt. Because I think about that, and I think you're right about the uncontrolled Band-Aid, and it's one of the... In a much safer sense, I try to do that with my students. Now, granted, we're reading right now, this week in my classes, Nozaki Shanjae's For Colored Girls Considered Suicide When the Rainbow's Enough.
That's a great book.
Yeah. And
that's great.
I brought in the yes! record player and all this. And, you know, speaking of child death, maybe when we think about this, but, you know, those kids die in The Night with Bo Willie Brown.
Yep.
Those kids get killed.
Yeah.
And, which is something she witnessed in San Francisco. She saw children being dangled from a balcony in San Francisco. And it's like, what do you do with that? And what do you do with her own feelings of depression and whatever? And this weird metaphor that we keep coming back in our conversation, seen to every single class, is, well, how do you take the Band-Aid off, slow or fast?
Fast. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and thinking about that is like a metaphor for how people deal with trauma.
Right.
Or do you just... I mean, you can rip it off fast and just know that it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
There is the slow peel, which is actually going to hurt more in a lot of ways.
I did the slow peel. that took about 5 years.
Yeah. And then, of course, I think there is the other, and I can confess there are things about my own life that I've done where you just leave it on there until it has more hair on it that's not yours. Oh. You know, the one flap kind of gets fuzzy and the other one's still hanging on. Oh, and you God. Just like kind of
that's totally gross.
Hope you know, or you soak it, and I guess maybe the soak is the controlled environment, the leaving it to fall off on its own is denial, and then there is the, you know, long, slow, drawn out. Or that, get it over with.
Right, get it over with.
And, you know, I guess it all comes back to me, from me, this consumerist impulse because the promise of consumerism is that you could have anything. And why would you want to ever feel bad?
But you know that's a lie, right?
Yeah, you know that's a lie, but I will say I think we both perhaps know people, and I certainly know people. I'm sorry, I'm saying that. I'm not picking anybody. If anybody's listening, it's like, it's you! You know, no. Any of our mutual friends, we're all cool. No judgment zone, all of that. But we've
However,
known each other
it sounds for... like you. No.
Yeah.
Seek help immediately.
Yes, but, you know, having known each other for 2 decades and having had over these 2 decades really intense experiences together.
Oh my goodness, yes.
You know, whether it was doing theater at St. Francis or both of our life trajectories since then have been interesting.
It's the epic story!
It's the epic story. You know, knowing people, and okay, I'll say this, I think my mother's one of them, who has never discovered this is a lie.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no,
but you know what? Here's the thing too. Here is where we can find empathy with our perceived enemies. They don't know it's a lie.
They don't know it's a lie. I mean, I guess the other thing is, it's like it, you know, I don't know, whatever metaphor you want. You know, the 300-pound toddler, the elephant in the china shop, whatever you want to say.
The elephant in the china shop.
You know, it's like even for some of those people, I think they don't necessarily know that they create the damage in other people's lives. Or quite how destructive they are, both internally and externally.
No, you're right. And honestly, I have to say, we can't even approach that yet, because I've thought about that. Like, not only do we get people to empathize with the other side, but now we get them to look at themselves and see the damage that they create out of their just daily living of consumerism, where they shop, what they do, consumers culture, blah, blah, blah. So I can't even fathom moving into that next step of seeing your own damage until we begin to empathize with the people on the other side, until... Yeah. All we see is that everybody is fighting for one thing, and that is the right to live.
Yeah.
The freedom to live. That's all we're doing, and we're all on the same page as far as that is concerned.
Yeah. I mean, I think about it, and it's over here in the corner, and it's another book I've taught, the graphic novella George Sprott by the Canadian artist Seth. And that novella is really interesting because it is incredibly empathetic. Yet George Sprott is not a likable human being. Mm-hmm. And it tells his life story, and it does other interesting things with memory. It's how do you remember a person whose world no longer exists?
Yeah.
It's like his era is gone, and the man is gone. And how can you ever tell the complete story of a person? Especially if a person is, like him, a very complicated, conflicted character who caused damage externally throughout his life and obviously internally. And there's this one spot that's buried somewhere in the book where there's like an interview with him, you know, and he says, you know, what's heaven, what's hell? And he said hell is, you know, whatever. Or he said, you know, he would like to think that life has meaning and that at some point before he dies, he'll figure it all out and see things with perfect clarity. And they later asked him what hell is. And he said, maybe that's what that is. To understand one's own life with perfect clarity. That might be a kind of a hell.
Ta-da!
Yeah, and... which brings me to this notion, and it's weird to think about, like, the kind of stuff, you know, the kind of people we are and the kind of stuff you're doing. I'm writing on naked people, or whatever.
Yeah.
And thinking about art as a moral imperative in these times, and how do we have some kind of responsibility as humans to be willing to explore this? And I think in our fun, carefree culture, you know, it's weird to think about moral imperatives.
It is.
It is, and especially within the counterculture, which I think we both identify with.
Yeah.
But in a weird way, I think I'm starting to think about sometimes the commitment to the art, commitment to humanities, commitment to exploring all aspects of the human experience, including the ugly ones.
Yes.
You know, as a weird kind of moral imperative, and how do we articulate that in this world that we live in? Because if it feels good, do it, right?
Right.
You know, you have this problem with, like, the left is having this identity crisis. The right, I think, has fallen into it and become completely amoral and completely ahistorical.
Yes.
And not even fucking know that is what has happened to those people. And here we are on the left, where you have this old kind of 60s ideal of, if it feels good, do it, man.
Yeah, but all of our 60s ideals have been capitalized. So yes. All you're doing is engaging in the system that is destroying it all anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, you're right.
You know,
that's hard. I mean, because to market yourself, I mean, it's even hard to market myself as the mad muse. I throw the word mad in there. Nobody wants to deal with the word mad. You know? So how do you roll in under the guise of feel good and then expose the, oh, by the way, ta-da! You know, how do you do it?
It is this weird bait and switch.
Yeah.
Then, you know?
But, you know, I try very hard. None of my work is completely 100% sunshine on my shoulder. I try very hard to balance it mm-hmm. with that darkness, with yeah. that. And it's not darkness. Here's the thing. We talk about darkness like it's an evil thing, and it's not. It's just the absence of light.
Yeah.
There's nothing evil about it.
Yeah.
And we avoid it like it's an evil thing. But if we don't accept it, you know, along with all those ideas of, like, death and, you know, hate and jealousy and anger, it doesn't go away. It still happens.
And repression breeds intensity.
Right. So, you got to get a gimmick.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I mean, that's part of my teaching persona, is it is a bait and switch.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't get people to be interested in something that will help them be successful in college and life on their own. You have to be a bit of a clown as you sell it. And I know that I do that.
Yeah.
You know. And I feel conflicted about that because I'm both buying in but also trying to subvert, you know, rather deal in absolutes. It's safer, it's comfortable, you know. But I pulled out, actually, you know, this book of quotes, actually, very quiet. I bet you didn't even hear me rustle my notebook, listener.
No.
I read recently this interview, this series of interviews with Simon Critchley, the British neo-Marxist, and he says, you know, about, you know, the 1960s were this kind of fundamentally libertarian thing. And maybe that's why it failed.
Oh.
And, you know, even the left was libertarian in the 60s. And now, you know, it's like people are and should be organizing around responsibility.
Right.
And that has echoed in my brain since I read that a couple weeks ago. And the idea of thinking about the movements that are happening and the things that people are doing now. Especially in the Lost in the Orange Menace Land era that we are in, is thinking about organizing around responsibility rather than just, hey, it's just fun. We're just gonna have fun. The revolution will be fun.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, no. Fuck that shit.
Well, you know what? I will say the exciting part of this, I feel like it's the 80s all over again. There's that little part of me that's just thrilled that we're back in the 80s.
You know, it's funny you should say that because,
like Red Dawn is coming. I'm like,
Red Dawn is coming.
Teenagers!
Or, you know, it's very strange you should say that. So we went to Bad Movie Night. There's this thing called Bad Movie Night. And they take a movie from 80s VHS culture or 70s exploitation and do like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 with it mashup and put it on the screen. And the most recent one we went to was Trax, starring,
oh my goodness,
yes, Shadow Stevens of the Top 40 Countdown and Hollywood Squares. And I guess he was Craig Ferguson's announcer.
Oh, yeah.
On Late Night Craig Ferguson. And he plays this, like, parody of the 80s action movie. But its fundamental core is cities are evil, non-white people are scary, and so you need a white guy with unrestrained, unlimited access to violence and power to tame all of that. And this was 88. And it was very much the sensibilities of its time. And I remember growing up as a kid in the suburbs and being like just afraid of cities. You know,
yeah.
My parents still are. I think we know some people up the mountain who still are.
Totally.
You know, afraid of the idea of a city and its diversity and all these people and all these things that could happen to you there. And, oh, my God. And I remember things like, oh, my God, this is a different movie now that we're watching this now that Trump's president.
Right.
Because that's his kind of adult formative years, maybe were the 80s, and this sensibility of what the world is and how it works. And we need this unrestrained power to tame the multitudes. And
yes, I was like, oh my crazy, God. Those crazy intellectuals.
Yeah. You know, and I think about that. I was like, oh my God. You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, again, my mom was, you know, well, if my mom was willing to vote, you know, she doesn't have a husband to kind of guide her through this anymore. So if she was willing to, if she could vote, you know, as a woman by herself, if that was possible in her ideological realm, she would, of course, would have voted for Trump.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everything is fear. I remember when, you know, there was the two movie theater shootings a couple years ago, and I remember I was like, oh, I'm going to the movies tonight. And she's, aren't you afraid? Of what?
You know what, though? No, but here's the thing. You're talking about your aged mother. You're talking, yes, about your mother.
Who was born in
43. Let's talk about how many people in their 20s that won't go out a night on their own. Like, this, yeah, fear is still, it's a social fear.
You know, I mean, yeah, it amazes me, like, the students I have that are afraid of driving.
Yeah. Cross a bridge.
Cross a bridge. I once had, you know, my students do a digital detox, and I had a student who said, you know, the worst part about it is you get on an elevator, and you're on an elevator for 90 seconds, and what do you do if you don't have a phone to look at? And you're just around strangers. With nothing to fixate you and nothing to carry you away from that.
So this fear, like, wow, that leads your mother's decisions in the sense of the city is scary.
Mm-hmm.
Is it getting better or worse because of our...
Well, at this point, I will say my mom doesn't really leave the house.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean in our younger generations.
In our younger generations,
because of lack of social, you know, engagement.
Yeah, I mean... It's a weird thing to see what's going to happen to these people and how they're going to age.
I know.
If I live long enough to see them go through different stages of life.
Look at us. We're in the kind of, if I live long enough. You would think it. Like,
you got to start thinking that way, you know?
Stop that.
You know. It could happen at any minute now.
Yeah, it could have before.
But I think it's just getting more. Because the fact that it hasn't happened yet, and don't call, you know, statisticians don't write in and call me on this. But if it hasn't happened yet, and you know it will eventually happen,
yes,
that means that the scale is slightly going up.
The chances are getting greater.
Yes, you know, if it hasn't happened yet, and you know it's going to, that means. Not that I didn't do a bunch of really crazy, stupid, dangerous things when I was 20.
Mm-hmm. I was there.
Yeah. Yes, you were. Yes, you were. And you know what? The other thing, too, is we didn't have camera phones back then.
I know.
Not that we're old people, but, you know, the level of surveillance that people live under, which makes, yeah, me think about, you know, your thing in the era of sexting. Mad Love in the era of sexting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where...
It's the opposite.
Yeah.
This is complete exposure, where sexting is complete hide behind it.
Yes. And I think that thing is, you're right, maybe that fear hasn't gone away, but there is this amazing thing called the smartphone that just allows people to retreat into that.
Yeah.
You know, and
Google makes us smart. I'm so much smarter now that I can Google things.
See, I feel the opposite. Because I was able to turn, and maybe it's old man neural pruning, but I was able to turn off a lot of the recall part of my brain and look into other things. You know, like, I used to know lots of stuff, and now I'm like, I don't know, I'll just look it up.
Right. Yeah. No, that's, you know, what I mean. I, yeah, was being sarcastic. Google, oh, does not, it makes us pseudo-intellectuals.
Yeah.
Essentially. Like,
it makes every bar argument.
I sound
argument.
So smart when I can Google something. As, yeah, long as I know the right question, I'm a genius.
Yeah.
Now think about that. Like, oh God.
Oh, we've become... I think now this is the old curmudgeon portion of the podcast. I know.
5 miles uphill.
Damn kids! When I was your age.
No, but I mean, in that, you know, like the vulnerability of engaging with people, I think we're getting further away from it. I think as artists and as people that create human pieces, humanistic pieces, now more than ever, because we've got screens in our way.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I wonder, I mean, what is the future, if the future contains sex bots.
I'm totally getting one.
Well, yes, I figured you would. But I think the question is then, if you can have a sex bot who will never age, will never reject you, will never get tired, and oh, by the way, could also probably, you know, take photos from social networks and embody the body of that person who got away, or the unrequited, or the high school crush. Yeah, are we years away, a generation away of people who then kind of want to try to live in a way that they don't need other people?
That's total sci-fi. You could read that in a bunch of sci-fi books,
yeah.
How that goes. And that's why I talk about deeper love. Mm-hmm. That's why I talk about human elements. Because, you know, it would be, sure, we would replace that imperfect relationship with a perfect partner. But we would get, it wouldn't feel any more emotion in us. We would be just as cold as the metal we touch. You know what I mean? Like in that sense of,
but it's safe, easy, convenient.
But that's the problem.
And probably dishwasher safe.
You know, the more we land, the more we head towards safe, easy, and convenient, the less human we become. And I mean, if that's where we're going, if we're going to head into like what, transhumanism and stuff like that, okay, fine. In the meantime, we're not there yet, so there are still people on the planet.
and I think there always will be people on the planet.
Yeah,
but
and
the capacity for—I mean, I think that's the other thing too. Is, I mean, in what degree has living like a rich old person become a mainstream thing for people? Or it's trying to be. Isn't that the promise? That you can just completely shut out of your world?
Yeah.
You know, and is that the hope for so many people?
That's the hope for so many people. Absolutely. But in that, and then, you know, like, and I'll even say this, working in customer service. Oh, my God. They've just become impossible. I mean, really, yeah. the level of expectation and entitlement of
and
your service,
immediate
is
red line
ridiculous.
Anger,
yeah. ridiculous. And you know what? I'm a nice kid, and then I'm not. it's just that, you know, like people are veering away from being decent human beings into, I can't stand people. I'm going to shut myself off the world. Well, because you're equally as impossible too.
Yeah. Maybe empathy. More so.
Yeah. Empathy. Yeah. Like, don't instantly launch after the person behind the counter. Take a moment.
Well, you know, I hate Psychology Today, but I did. You know, sometimes you have a relative that sells Girl Scout cookies and Girl Scout magazine subscriptions, and you end up with 6 issues of Psychology Today.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. You know, somebody, yeah, so that's the thing. I mean, somebody shoves a 9mm in your face and takes your wallet and you get gets the $40. That's robbery, but, you know.
Right.
Fundraising magazine subscriptions, $44 for Psychology Today. That's not robbery. That's fundraising. but there was one in there. Then it was it was weird. It was this cartoon picture of Ann Coulter, and the headline was called The Politics of Entitlement.
There it is.
You know, and the idea that in people's lives they use anger as a strategy as to manipulate and change situations, and is the politics of sort of right-wing anger, righteous anger, just the political social dimension of that strategy. You know, and how many people love the righteous anger of that man.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh,
identify,
absolutely.
Which
yeah.
is my mom.
Yeah.
My mom,
yeah,
absolutely.
Absolutely. Because they didn't get what they were promised.
Yes.
Where's my prize? We should be doing Sondheim. No, and that's there's the empathy. These people are lost because they didn't get what they were promised. But you're at, yeah, and it's that entitlement of like where, what, but at the same time, now let's talk about righteous anger.
Yeah.
I love righteous anger. I use it all the time. One of my favorite things to do, especially when I'm in, like the Blue Moon, you know, Pittsburgh's best gay bar, I'm standing up on the stage. And when I talk about us, I mean, those of us in this bar, that are a marginalized community.
Yeah.
And the next thing that launches out of my mouth is, fuck those people. I like my righteous anger.
Yeah.
And I promote that.
Well, I think it's different if you're legitimately aggrieved.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's that difference between legitimately aggrieved and upset that other people might have a small...
Well, I just wanted to make sure that yeah, both sides that, can use
but
righteous
I wonder,
anger.
Well, both sides can use righteous anger. I just wonder, you know, is it time to start thinking about other models? In other ways, and how do you shut down righteous anger and entitlement politics?
Don't ask me that.
I it's a rhetorical question.
I have the worst answer. Is one good day in a guillotine?
Yeah. Hey, the Reign of Terror is a bit longer.
I know.
So, can we do the rundown again before we get to the bottom five? Can we do the rundown of? Projects, things, or more importantly, maybe how do we, and there'll be links, how do we find out about the Mad Muse and all things Mad Muse?
All things Mad Muse, you can go to www.musegonemad.com. That's my website. You can go to www.patreon.com/themadmuse. If you would like to become a subscriber and become my Patreon, become my patron, like, you know, to support my performances and be a friend. Where else? Of course, I'm on Facebook as The Mad Muse. I'm on Instagram as The Mad Muse, Twitter, The Mad Muse, Google Mad Muse. You will find me. All the events are out there. The Literary Brothel, the Atrocity Exhibition, Shen Fringe, and this podcast too.
Yes, there you go. And now it's time for the bottom five.
Yay, I haven't done this in a while.
Yes, the bottom five, so there's new questions. You're going to get all new questions. And now it's time for the bottom five, a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Question one. What is the strangest item you have eaten and or found in your stool?
Hair.
Hair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hair.
That sounds pretty...
It's just weird finding hair in your stool.
Yeah.
Like, how'd you get hair in your poop?
Oh, boy.
You had to have eaten it if it got there.
Fair enough. Question two. Sorry, making a last-minute change. I'm calling an audible here. Question two, which is a popular one as of late. Those of you regular listeners, Ren, I'm talking to you. If we were living in a dystopian future, and the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin, meaning, you know, dystopian anti-knowledge, no books, but only if people are willing to sacrifice their human skin, march that volume, untuck it under their shoulder, and march themselves right to the tannery... What book would you, and what book would you donate your skin for? And you can't say the Bible, the Quran, or the complete works of Shakespeare. People are on that, okay? People went. Those are taken care of. Okay? Those are like top five, okay? So they're cop-out answers. So we have to take cop-out answers off. Would you donate your body, your skin, so that... And if you don't... This knowledge, this text, this human understanding does not survive into the future.
Oh, I'd probably give my skin up for Hal.
Hal and Other Poems, Battle and Ginsburg?
Yep.
Excellent choice.
Yeah, I'd give up my skin for Hal. That's important. For Ginsburg, absolutely.
Yes. Fantastic. Question three. If there is a hell... And you end up there, speaking of Dante. If there's a hell, see, these are related. These and the last good. One will be related. If there is a hell and you end up there, name one celebrity that you expect slash hope to meet.
In hell?
In hell.
Celebrity.
That you would love to meet in hell. If you end up there and it's a real place.
Oh, wow.
Can't just pick one, can you?
I know, there's so many. I'm like, gee, there's like a ton. Because the party's in hell.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the...
We're now back to Mark Twain, the letters from the earth, right? I know. Parties in hell would be better parties.
So maybe that's who I need to meet. I need to meet Mark Twain in hell.
There you go. Is. You do a lot worse. Question four. What mundane daily activity gives you the most joy?
This is terrible. I just love to sit on the toilet and take a poop. It's yeah. so nice. Taking a dump. Since we're talking about poop, it must be in my head right now. I don't know. But I was just like, you know, it's just sometimes just it's a menial thing. Just sit down.
It's a moment of zen, isn't it?
Right.
Yes.
It's the throne.
And it's one of Freud's stages, but we won't get into that. And question five, I had to change this to add this one for the emotional stripper. Describe a time, this is more not a question, this is a prompt. Describe a time when you saw someone naked but shouldn't have.
When I saw someone naked and I shouldn't have.
Yeah. Some sort of accidental, like, oh, you forgot to lock the door.
Oh, wow. That happens so many times.
It's like people meeting in hell. You know?
Yeah. Like, so, yeah, that's like, that's, See, the thing is most of the time it should be me because I should never run into naked people. For as much as I'm doing Mad Love, I'd be like, oh, get naked. If I walk into a room and somebody's naked, I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, like, I'm instantly the one to react, whether they care or not. So, yeah. Any random naked person.
Any random naked person. Well, on that note, I think that's about it. Google Mad Muse, musegonemad.com. There'll be links embedded in this MP3. There'll be links on the website. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, where you can find those new and old episodes, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook.
Woo!
Later, meets.